earlier today, it was the honor to give them a call lecture at the seminary on leadership. And I had told Dr. Mueller beforehand that I'm not, nor have I ever been a theologian or a preacher. He said, don't worry, that's not what we're looking for. We wouldn't have asked you if that was it. And that's good. We want you to talk about leaders and leadership. And then we're going to come to leadership luncheon and talk about that. And so I drew from personal experience, and I referenced the fact that my friend Eric Metaxas has just written a new book called Miracles, in which he only uses first-person testimony. And I had written a book last year on the happiest life in which I only used first-person testimony. I needed to know people in order for me to put into the book a story that I would use so that I could verify it. And today I just used examples from leaders I've been lucky enough. I mean, I have been blessed in being at the right place at the right time. When I got out of Harvard in 1978, I did not have a job. I had been turned down from Michigan and Harvard Law Schools, which are the only two law schools I wanted to go to. And I was sitting on the steps of the house, Winthrop House. Any Harvard guys here? Harvard men or women? Okay, it's a little college up north. And we have houses that you live in. And I should have known it wouldn't have any purchase at all in Kentucky. I had no job. I had no idea. And a guy walked by, Ed Mansfield. He said, Hugh, what are you doing next year? And I said, I don't know. And he said one of the eight words. There are two sets of four words which are the most important you can hear outside of the gospel in this life. The first four are, I know a guy. And the second four are, have you ever considered? And the I know a guy is a clue that someone's about to offer you an opportunity. And Ed Mansfield said, I know a guy in Washington, D.C. named Ray Price, and he needs a research assistant. Why don't you call him? So I picked up the phone, I called Ray Price, and he said, yeah, I do. I'm going to write a book on the media. He lived in Georgetown. He had been President Nixon's chief speech writer. Why don't you come down to Washington, D.C. in a month? I'm going to be here in a month, and we'll talk about whether or not you can. I thought, I got to have a job. Hooray. And so I went to Washington, D.C. for only the second time in my life in the spring of 1978, and I presented myself at the time appointed at Ray Price's house in Georgetown on Prospect Avenue, Prospect Street. And he opened the door, said, who are you? And I'm Hugh Hewitt. I had brown hair then. I was younger. So I'm Hugh. I'm here to interview for your research assistant. And he literally went, which is not a good sign. It's a sign something's gone wrong. He said, I am so sorry. I forgot. I forgot you were coming. And I forgot we had discussed having a job. I've been called by President Nixon to go to San Clemente and help him join his staff. But come on in. Let's talk. And in the course of this, we go in and we talk, and he makes a couple of phone calls. And before I leave, he says those words again. Have you ever considered? And that meant, have you ever considered? He then said, David Eisenhower is looking for a research assistant for his book on his father, which eventually became Eisenhower at War, which is a fine one-volume book on, in fact, it's award-winning, one-volume book on Eisenhower's generalship. He's looking for a research assistant in San Clemente, California. Have you ever considered moving to California? He said, I don't have a job. I don't even make an impression upon people enough to that they remember I'm coming to their house. You betcha. So I go back up, and a couple of days later, the phone rings, and it's Julie Eisenhower. David is traveling. He says, we hear you're pretty good. You want to come out here? We'll pay you the unearthly sum of $10,000 for a year. And I didn't know how much money that was. I said, you betcha. I get my Dodge Dart Sport, drove across the country, went to San Clemente, didn't realize that what Ray had actually set up was sort of like a three-month trial period to see whether or not I could be his real research assistant and editorial assistant on the real war for President Nixon. And I'm going to use my short time today. I spoke a little bit earlier about President Nixon and my time as a young man with him. And then he called me back to his service in 1989 to oversee the construction of the Nixon Library. And just a few qualities about President Nixon in the leadership field, since people don't now remember. They know a lot about Reagan. They know a lot about Churchill. But Nixon had some extraordinary qualities about leadership that I like to talk to people about. And the first one of which is the one I mentioned at McCall today. When I arrived in San Clemente in the summer of 1978, he was not at the low point of his life. The low point of his life had been 1974. And soon after he went to San Clemente and was in exile, he had developed near-fatal phlebitis, and Mrs. Nixon had had a stroke, and he was out of money, and he was being sued and pursued and not yet pardoned. And that was the low point of his life. And it gradually crested up, and I joined the staff of David in June of 1978, and then I joined his staff in September or October, I can't quite remember which, that fall after 3 or 4 months with David, and they were vetting me, figuring out whether or not I would be indiscreet. So you had to be very discreet to work for President Nixon. Everyone wanted to get in those days. And he made a practice his entire retirement of bringing young people into his orbit. And I talked about this over at the seminary today, as do a lot of great men. Churchill always had about him Jock Colville or someone like that, as does Dr. Moeller, because that's how you teach leadership. You mentor young men and women by having them in close proximity to you, doing that stuff of which it's done. And Nixon made a habit of that. And as a result, there are people who are running around today. I'm 58. Who spent hours and hours and hours with Nixon. If I'm blessed with a regular span, I can keep doing so and talking about and telling a few things about him that people then can carry forward. But he had not hit bottom in 74 and had begun to crest up. He'd had the Frost interviews, which made him money, and the movie Nixon Frost, remarkable film. How many have seen it? Frank Langella plays Nixon, and I'm here to tell you, as a guy who knew him 3 months after that period, physically captured the essence of Richard Nixon, who was an awkward man, extremely ill-coordinated and ill at ease with small talk. But one of the great things about Nixon, my parents came out November that year, and they'd never met any United States president, small town lawyer, homemaker, nurse, gone off to the war. So here's a, I called up, I said, Mr. President, I bring my parents over. And he said, sure, bring them over. One of the great things I find about leaders is that they are incredibly gracious with the details of people's lives for those who work. Nixon followed me throughout my entire life, was always very solicitous of my children, my career. That's what great leaders do about the people who've served them well. They don't throw away those who've served them. They attend to them, some more than others. Churchill was a little bit notoriously indifferent to the ups and downs, but felt deeply the ups and downs of his life. But Nixon brought my family and my parents, and they're tongue-tied. They don't know what to say. And so this is an awkward, I'm 22, and no one's saying anything after he said, I was in Warren, Ohio in 1960 when I campaigned. Oh, yes, we saw you in the parade. Silence. We're looking out at the Pacific. Then my mom, God bless her soul, said, what's going to happen with China? And 2 hours later, we left. And he did most of the talking because it was a serious subject. And they asked serious questions. Once he got to that, the land of firm footing on serious subjects, he was comfortable talking to anyone, as great leaders are, as politicians are, but he was bad at small talk. Second observation he taught me about leadership, to be good with the people around you and with their families is an important lesson. Second thing is to be aware of the bubble in which you live. Now, I tell this story often, and it always, Bill Bennett loves this story more than any he's heard me tell. And it goes to what happens when you're in America's leadership elite. When President Nixon was getting ready to leave from San Clemente to New York, the staff, Ray Price, Jack Brennan, Paul Bateman, and I were very joyful to hear he was going to take a three-day RV trip with Bebe Rebozo to the Grand Canyon. It's a little hard to get your mind around, but George Argyros, who was eventually ambassador to Spain under President Bush, lent him his RV, and we drove around one day looking at his old home, which would eventually become his Nixon library, and it was very odd to be in the RV with President Nixon, and people would look over and they'd see President Nixon in the front of the RV and they'd try to drive off the road. So the Secret Service made a move into the back, and we went into a restaurant, and it was a pretty unusual experience. When you're walking around with Richard Nixon, you're 22, it's an unusual experience. But he wasn't taking us. We were happy because we're going to move the manuscript of the book during those 4 days. And in 1980, the difficulty that attends the moving of a manuscript is its paper. It's not PDF. And if you lose it, you're really, really in a bad place. And so you're trying not only not to lose it, you're trying not to lose the drafts, and you're trying not to lose the research material. I'm sure Dr. Moeller, anyone else here who's written a book knows. In 1980, this was a significant thing. And we didn't want him around for 4 days. We wanted him gone because he was a problem in terms of getting anything done because he was constantly revising his work. So they pull off in this RV, and we're thinking we'll have 4 days. Hoorah. He's gone with Bebe and four Secret Service agents. They're back in 6 hours. Hadn't even left San Clemente. These were the little tilt-ups that the government immediately tore down. And I look out my window. I have old Al Haig's old office, and I'm downcast when I see the RV pull up, and RN gets off, and he stalks off over to La Costa Pacifica. And Bebe gets off, and he stalks off over to the residence as well. And I walk out, and I said to the head of the detail, I said, what in the world happened? He said, I decided 3 hours into this, this was the worst idea they'd ever had, and that they were not going to enjoy driving. They weren't even enjoying each other's company, but we did have something interesting happen. I said, what's that? He said, well, they'd brought along some Lafitte 36. I'm not a drinker. I'm not a wine person, so I don't know what that is, but I am told that it is a fine bottle of wine, Lafitte 36. And they discovered as they got ready for lunch to serve the Lafitte, they did not have a corkscrew. So the president said, get me to a place where we can get a corkscrew. Now, the Secret Service are trained professionals. They'll take a bullet for you, but they are not your valets, and they do not do your shopping. And so when they pulled in to the Kmart, President Nixon, Bebe Rebozo, and two Secret Service agents went into the Kmart. And they came out an hour later. And I said to the head of the detail an hour, and he said, oh, yeah, the old man says to me, have you ever been in one of those? They've got everything in there. They've got furniture and dresses. And he had gone up and down the aisle of the Kmart, every single aisle, because in 1980, Richard Nixon had never been in a Kmart. He had gone from being the vice president of the United States, living in the bubble, to being a white shoe lawyer on Wall Street, to running for governor and losing, and then going right back to being a white shoe lawyer on Wall Street and never, ever doing his own marketing, never, ever. And then into the White House, which is the biggest bubble of them all, and then into exile at the Elba of America, not knowing that all around him the country was changing radically, rapidly. Blue mark, blue light specials arrived on his watch, and he was unaware of it. And we know that this is a problem for leaders. We know that they can lose touch with everything that's going on around them because they live cosseted by staff and secure against the ups and downs and the whiplashes of life. People are trying to keep them focused on making decisions. And it showed me, I'll never forget that, that it's very hard to remain connected with what's going on. It's very important to do so. Today I spoke to the students about the necessity of being immersed in social media. Now, this is an older crowd. How many of you have Twitter accounts? Well, God bless you all. It's important. And it's important because it's a space in which the battle, both gospel and cultural, political and social, is unending and going on 24/7. I left the McCall lecture, went over to call my wife, take 10 minutes of get-it-together time, checked the Twitter feed and discovered that more than a dozen people have been tweeting from the lecture, which is very encouraging to me. That's how things move at the speed of sound. Dan Balz is one of the finest political reporters in America, and I was honored in his book on the 2012 presidential campaign. I'm reading along, and all of a sudden he quotes a tweet that I sent out in the middle of the presidential debate. And I thought to myself, it's the first time I've been quoted in other books before, but it's the first time one of my tweets made it into a book. And he realized and he wrote about the fact that presidential debates don't need spin rooms anymore. They are spun before they're done. You can't change the impression of what has happened in the debate because of what is happening online instantly with the delivery of the remarks. So the cake is baked when they leave the stage, and it's baked by 1,000 million chefs who are watching. So if people are committed to gospel and to conservative values are not online, we've lost. It's like not showing up. I hope the Bengals don't show up tonight. How many of you are Bengals fans? Oh, good. You won't even admit it. How many of you are Browns fans? I am a season ticket holder to the Cleveland Browns and have been since 1999. I give them to my brother. I told him I will come back for the playoff game. That has not happened yet. This is the year that this is going to happen. Tonight is the night. Dr. Mueller was inviting me out tonight. I said, Al, really? I got to watch the Browns game tonight. I'm kind of into this very deeply. But so was Richard Nixon. He was deeply invested in this. But what I told him today is be involved in social media and don't allow an area of the culture war to go unmatched. And it is not going unmatched. Now, what I also told him about Richard Nixon, which was the most important lesson, I'm going to transition to W and then be done, is that Nixon proved that you are never down and out. You are never finished. My guess, and obviously it would take a lot of interviews, I've done a lot of interviews, if I spent time with each of you around this room, you'll know your worst day, or at least you'll know your worst week, or if you've done your best to suppress it, your worst month. And you'll know why it was your worst day or your worst week or your worst month. Everyone's got one. Everyone's got a best day of their life and a worst day of their life. And everyone's got a best achievement and everyone's got the worst defeat. And for sports people, my friend Frank Pastore, a late great Cincinnati Reds pitcher, if you're Reds fans here, Frank toiled away as a innings eater, as they say, for many years for the Reds. And he gave up a lot of long balls. And Frank followed me. He was my guest host for years, and he took over a Christian radio station. Great man of word and faith. Became a great talk show host. Died in a motorcycle accident a couple of years ago. But Frank said that you can ask any professional ball player, when did an umpire worst screw you? And they'll immediately be able to tell you, immediately, when the umpire worst call against them. Because you remember these things. Well, we all know these worst days. No one had a worse political situation than Richard Nixon in 1974. And when he died in 1994, five presidents came, a host of dignitaries from around the world, and the world stopped. It was a weird day in Yorba Linda, by the way. It was overcast. It was stormy. It was thundering in the middle of summer, right? This was just an odd thing. And Kissinger said he went from pinnacles to precipice, dissolving beneath him. And yet he climbed himself out of the abyss because he willed himself not to become irrelevant. And so when he was sitting there recovering from phlebitis, he planned it out. He planned going to Oxford. He planned the Frost interviews. He had a plan to recover from disastrous defeat. And I think leaders do that. Churchill, I'm sure Dr. Mueller could do this at greater length than I. No one has ever had their career over more times than Winston Churchill. It just ruined, disaster, from Gallipoli to the India crisis to the abdication crisis, over, done. And yet the Times called forth the man, and he was there in 1938 and 39, when he had to step up and save Western civilization. So I really do believe that. I think the Times bring forward the man, but they've got to be willing not to quit when the Times don't appear to be on their side. And Nixon really modeled that for me, and I think it's really the greatest lesson. It's going to be his legacy, is not opening China, the highlight of his tenure, or negotiating to a stalemate with the Soviets, number two, and it's not going to be the disgrace of the criminality and the resignation, which is enduring and kids will know about it. It's going to be the example of post-presidency leadership. It's going to be the example of refusing to allow defeat to define you and redefining yourself, coming back to that position of elder statesman, which brings me in my last 5 minutes to President Bush. As I said earlier today, it's difficult for me to overstate my admiration for him. And my boss, the owner of the Salem Radio Network, Edward Atzinger, said, it is unlikely that American Christianity will ever have again a president so deeply connected to what causes their blood to circulate in their heart to beat. It's very unlikely that we will ever have a man or a woman in the office as deeply committed to gospel teaching as George W. Bush. I pray that's not the case, but it's unlikely given the modern culture and the way that we, the values that we'll have to embrace. W is the real deal. And he would occasionally have talk show hosts in to talk. And I've seen him since in the presidency. I'm not close to him. I don't want to make it sound like he's a friend. He's not. I'm just a talk show host that he invited along with other talk show hosts to the White House because he knew that you had to work the refs. And he worked the refs all the time. There was an unending flow of public intellectuals and talking heads into the White House because he was working the refs every single day on the war because he knew it was important. So he'd call us back in. And the first time I went, which was on August 1st, 2007, the war was not going well. The surge was underway. He thought we'd turn the corner. And we were late. We were there on time. We weren't going to be late for the president. Although the wonderful Neil Bortz managed to have his phone go off in the course of this. And I always tease him about that because the president, if looks could kill, Neil Bortz had been dead 10 years now. But we were waiting in the Teddy Roosevelt room, and we were delayed. And when we came in, the president apologized as he seated us. He had been on a teleconference with Prime Minister Maliki, recently departed Prime Minister of Iraq. He said, I'm trying to teach these guys how to lead. He said, they have no experience of leadership. And it occurred to me he was right. Iraq had been run by one man, a sadistic, insane sociopath, and his two crazy kids for 20 years. There is no leadership class. There's no mentoring going on in Iraq. And so he was trying to build from the ground up via teleconference and personal connection with Karzai and Maliki and the other Arab leaders that he would deal with, the ethic of responsibility that goes with being a democratic elected leader. You know, when Maliki stepped down this year, I thought back to that meeting because I didn't think he was going to go. I thought we're going to have a coup in Iraq and that would have led to the division right then between Shia and Sunni and the end of the Iraq experiment, and Maliki gave up. And I wonder how much of the echo, President Obama was pressuring him to do it as well. It's a shared victory between President Obama and President, that they had a peaceful transfer of power in an Arab regime. That has not happened. And so that's really an amazing thing that's overlooked. They just had another one in Afghanistan, not an Arab regime, but a Muslim regime that came out of years of brutal war. They had a peaceful transition of power, which is they've not achieved this in the Palestinian state. They've not achieved this in Egypt. It's a very hard thing to do, to build that culture. We've achieved it in South America, in places like Brazil and Argentina and Chile. This is what defines freedom, is when you can, okay, my turn is up. Or as Vice President Cheney said to me once, we only get 8 years. That's what Washington did for us. That's what Lincoln reclaimed for us, is the idea of civil government. So W calls in that with lesson leadership number two. Number two, on the last Wednesday of his presidency, same six-pack, Bennett, Bortz, Medved, Ingram, and Levin. And we're sitting around, and we had an hour and a half with him. On the last Wednesday of his presidency, the guy's down to 160 hours of being president. Why are you wasting time on talking heads? And it was a revelation. It was off the record, so I can't quote him. I will paraphrase him as I did earlier today. He called us there to urge us to give the new guy a chance and not to be hyperbolic or instantaneous in our criticism of it, that it was a very hard job and that he was confident that the seriousness of it would descend upon President Obama and that the political differences when it became leader of the free world were so important that we not go after him with a buzzsaw immediately, that we give him the opportunity to become the president. And, you know, I heard, I'm sure he did that one-on-one with Rush, because Rush was often there. I'm sure he did that with Sean. And then, you know, the B team, the people with, I've got 2 million listeners a week and Rush has got 20. That's the difference between A team and B team. And that's fine. God calls us different things. But he did that. He worked those refs on behalf of his successor, who had said some pretty harsh things about him. And has since, have you ever heard a word of criticism, President Bush, out of President Bush about President Obama? The answer is no, you have not. Unless you have been alone with him on the ranch, and I've never been there, I have not heard a word of criticism. Third Bush story, final Bush story, 3 years ago, Alliance Defending Freedom had me down to Dallas to do a fundraiser, which involved interviewing the president, which I love to do. He's a great talker. He's a tremendous storyteller. So proud of the work he did in Africa. So eager to tell people that places like the seminary that produces people who are willing to go into harm's way and to spread the gospel are worth it. I asked him at that dinner, are you an optimist? And he said, I just came from a prayer meeting in South Korea, 60,000 people. How can I not be an optimist? And you know, just that sort of thing. But there, we're standing off before we go out. He said, there's only one rule. Forget what the staff told you. The staff gave me sheets and sheets of instruction. Speaker bureaus are for the birds. But he said, there's only one rule. He said, you can ask me any question you want, but I'm not going to answer any questions about President Obama. I mean, the guy is so classy. Just the complete embodiment of civic restraint and understanding that the office can only be held by one person at a time. And even after a repudiation election like this, I hope you noticed your great man of Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, is going to be a great man. And that's because of the way he exercised yesterday. I can do the touchdown jab. I can do the football spike. And I have been, and I will continue to do so for a few days. It was a big win. Significant course correction. Enormous repudiation of the president. Leader McConnell did not do that. He stepped up to the microphone yesterday, and he laid out a constructive path. And the door is open to making some. I don't think the president's going to walk through that door. He gave a less than optimistic sounding and reassuring conversation with the American people yesterday. But leadership shows up as often in defeat as it does in victory. It is often available to people at the moments you don't understand. And it's exercised by people who find it very hard to stay connected to the world they're in. Thank you for supporting this institution, for coming to Leadership Luncheon. You're bringing up a generation of young men and women who are going to be extraordinarily important for a time of challenges that, as I discussed today, be online, you can watch it, are staggering, much more difficult than Cold War choices, which were bipolar. And you're supporting that work, and you can't do that enough. And every dollar you've invested and every prayer that you've given on behalf of Dr. Mueller and his team is just so deeply appreciated. People like me who live in the secular world know what we do is fleeting and what they do is eternal. Thank you very much, Doctor.